In New York, during the weeks preceding the last voyage of the Lusitania, there was much gossip of submarines. It was freely stated and generally believed that a special effort was to be made to sink the great Cunarder so as to inspire the world with terror. On Saturday, May the 1st, the day on which the Lusitania was to sail, in order that there might be no mistake as to German intentions, the German embassy at Washington issued a warning to passengers, couched in general terms, which was printed in the New York morning papers, directly under the notice of the sailing of the Lusitania. There were some 2,000 people aboard altogether, counting passengers and crew. Curiously enough, there were a large number of children on the passenger list. We noticed this with some surprise. We were due to arrive in Liverpool on Saturday, May the 8th, and we had all imagined that the attempt would be made in the Irish Sea during our last night. We were wrong. On the Friday afternoon, at about 2 o'clock, we were off the southwest coast of Ireland. The old head of Kinsale was visible in the distance. My father and I had just come out of the dining room after lunching and were strolling into the lift on D-deck. He said, "I think we might stay up on deck tonight and see if we get our thrill." I had no time to answer. There was a dull thud, not very loud, but unmistakably an explosion. It seemed to come from a little below us at about the middle of the vessel on the port side. That was the side towards the land. I turned and came out of the lift. Somehow the stairs seemed safer. My father walked out over to look out of a porthole. I didn't wait. Days before, I'd made up my mind that if anything happened, one's instinct would be to make straight for the boat deck. It's a horrible feeling to stay under cover, even for a few moments, in a boat that may be sinking. But that in spite of that, I must control my instinct and go first to my cabin to fetch my life belt and then onto the boat deck. As I ran up the stairs, the boat was already heeling over. As I ran, I thought, "I wonder I'm not more frightened." And then, "I'm beginning to get frightened, but I mustn't let myself." I collected my life belt. On my way back, I ran into my father's cabin and took out one of his belts. There were 4 packed away in his cupboard. I was afraid that he might be occupied with his papers and forget to fetch one for himself. Then I went up to A deck, the boat deck. Here, there was, of course, a choice of sides. I chose the starboard side, feeling that it would somehow be safer to be as far away from the submarine as possible. I was wrong, of course. The side further from the submarine was also the higher out of the water, as the boat had listed over towards the side on which she had been hit, and the deck was now slanting at a considerable angle. There were a lot of foreign passengers on board, and just after I reached the deck, a stream of these came rushing up from below and fought their way into the boat nearest us, which was being lowered. They were white-faced and terrified. I think they were shrieking. There was no kind of order. The strongest got there first. The weak were pushed aside. Here and there a man had his arm round a woman's waist and bore her along with him. But there were no children to be seen. No children could have lived in that throng. They rushed the boat before it was ready. 2 seamen began to lower the boat, which was full to overflowing, but no one was in command of them. One man lowered his end quickly. The other lowered his end slowly. The boat was almost perpendicular when it reached the water. 1/2 the people fell out. The boat didn't capsize, and I think most of them scrambled back afterwards. I don't know. We turned away and didn't look. It wasn't wise to look at horrible things just then. Curious that it never for a moment struck any of us as possible to attempt to get into the boat ourselves. Even at that moment, death would have seemed better than to make part of that terror-infected crowd. I remember regretfully thinking something of the sort. That was the last boat I saw lowered. It became impossible to lower any more from our side, owing to the list on the ship. No one else except that white-faced stream seemed to lose control. A number of people were moving about the deck, gently and vaguely. They reminded one of a swarm of bees who do not know where the queen has gone. Whilst we were standing, I unhooked my skirt so that it should come straight off and not impede me in the water. The list on the ship soon became very bad. Presently, someone said he thought we'd better jump into the sea. He moved towards the edge of the deck where the boat had been, and there was no railing. I followed, feeling frightened at the idea of jumping so far. It was, I believe, some 60 feet normally from A deck to the sea. I remember telling myself how ridiculous I was to have a physical fear of the jump when we stood in such grave danger as we did. I think others must have had the same fear, for a little crowd stood hesitating on the brink and kept me back. And then, suddenly, I saw that the water had come over onto the deck. We were not, as I had thought, 60 feet above the sea. We were already under the sea. I saw the water, green, just about up to my knees. The next thing I can remember was being deep down under the water. It was very dark, nearly black. I fought to come up. I was terrified of being caught on some part of the ship and kept down. That was the worst moment of terror, the only moment of acute terror that I knew. My wrist did catch on some rope. I was scarcely aware of it at the time, but I have the mark on me to this day. At first I swallowed a lot of water. Then I remembered that I had read that one should not swallow water, so I shut my mouth. Something bothered me in my right hand and prevented me striking out with it. I discovered that it was a life belt I had been holding for my father. I let it go. As I reached the surface, I grasped a little bit of board, quite thin, a few inches wide and perhaps 2 or 3 feet long. I thought this was keeping me afloat. I was wrong. My most excellent life belt was doing that. Everything that happened after I had been submerged was a little misty and vague. When I came to the surface, I found that I formed part of a large, round, floating island composed of people and debris of all sorts, lying so close together that at first there was not very much water noticeable in between. People, boats, hen coops, chairs, rafts, boards, and goodness knows what besides, all floating cheek by jowl. Many people were praying aloud in a curious, unemotional monotone. Others were shouting for help in much the same slow, impersonal chant. Boat, boat, boat. I shouted for a minute or two, but it was obvious that there was no chance of any boat responding, so I soon desisted. One or two boats were visible, but they were a long way away from where I was, and clearly had all they could do to pick up the people close beside them. So far as I could see, they did not appear to be moving much. By and by, my legs got bitterly cold. There was no acute feeling of fear while one was floating in the water. I can remember feeling thankful that I had not been drowned underneath, but had reached the surface safely, and thinking that even if the worst happened, there could be nothing unbearable to go through now that my head was above water. I doubt whether any of the people in the water were acutely frightened or in any consciously unbearable agony of mind. When death is as close as he was then, the sharp agony of fear is not there. The thing is too overwhelming and stunning for that. One had the sense of something taking care of one. I don't mean in the sense of protecting one from death, rather of death itself being a benignant power. At moments, I wondered whether the whole thing was perhaps a nightmare from which I should wake. And once, half laughing, I think, I wondered, looking round on the sun and pale blue sky and calm sea, whether I'd reached heaven without knowing it, and devoutly hoped I hadn't. I was acutely uncomfortable, no more than that. Discomfort due mainly to the intense cold, but further, in my case at least, to the fact of being a very bad sailor. When presently a little swell got up, I was seasick. I remember as I sat in the water, I thought out an improvement which I considered should be adopted in the case of all life belts. There should be, I thought, a little bottle of chloroform strapped into each belt so that one could inhale it and lose consciousness when one wished to. I must have been exceedingly uncomfortable before I thought of that. The swell of the sea had the effect of causing the close-packed island of wreckage and people to drift apart. Presently, I was 100 yards or more away from anyone else. I looked up at the sun, which was high in the sky, and wished that I might lose consciousness. I don't know how long after that it was that I did lose it, but that is the last thing I remember in the water. The next thing I remember is lying naked between blankets on a deck in the dark. I discovered later, on a tiny patrol steamer named the Bluebell. Every now and again a sailor came and looked at me and said, "That's better." Gradually memory came back. The sailor offered me a cup of lukewarm tea, which I drank. We were on a teetotal vessel. There did not seem much wrong with me, except that my whole body was shaking violently and my teeth were chattering like castanets, as I had never supposed teeth could chatter, and that I had a violent pain in the small of my back. The sailor said he thought I'd better go below, as it would be warmer. We left you up here to begin with, he explained, as we thought you were dead, and it didn't seem worthwhile cumbering up the cabin with you. I was put into the captain's bunk, from whence someone rather further recovered was ejected to make room for me. The warmth below was delicious. It seemed to make one almost delirious. I should say that almost all of us down there were a little drunk with the heat and the light and the joy of knowing ourselves to be alive. We were talking at the tops of our voices and laughing a great deal. At one time I was talking and laughing with some woman when a sailor came in and asked if we had lost anyone in the wreck. I can remember the sudden sobering with which we answered. I didn't know what had happened to my father. She was almost sure that her husband was drowned. She'd already told me there are no veils just after a shipwreck. He was all she had in the world. It seemed that his loss probably meant the breaking up of her whole life, yet at that moment she was full of cheerfulness and laughter. It must have been about 9:30 at night when I came to myself on board the Bluebell. As to the interval, I heard afterwards that I had been picked up at dusk by a rowing boat, that in the gathering darkness they had very nearly missed me, but that by some curious chance a wicker chair had floated up under me. It must have happened after I lost consciousness, and that this chair had both helped to raise me further out of the water than I would otherwise have floated, and so likely enough saved my life by lessening the strain on me, and had made a slightly larger mark which had been noticed in the water, and they had rowed to it. The little boat had transferred me to the Bluebell. I was handed up to it along with a lot of dead bodies, but the midshipman who handed me on board said, "I rather think of some life in this woman. You'd better try and see." So they did. They told me that when I recovered, I went straight off to sleep without regaining consciousness and slept for 2 hours before I came to myself on the deck of the Bluebell in the dark. We got into Queenstown Harbour about 11. A man, the steward who had waited at our table on the Lusitania, came on board and told me that my father had been rescued and was already on shore. When we were made fast alongside, he was waiting at the other end of the gangway.